While intense fighting continues in Gaza, what happens after the war ends?
Palestinians want and need legitimate leaders.
Ukraine hits a Russian ship in Odessa with a cruise missile.
The strike could hinder Russian attempts to seize more Ukrainian territory along the Black Sea coast.
And living on the moon, that's the plan. And the plans for building a city on the moon have begun.
You want to be able, for example, to have tourists. All right, well, tourists are going to have to be in a hotel. Well, I got to build a hotel.
Today is Wednesday, December 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Heavy fighting continues in Gaza, and Israel has warned the war will last for many more months. But both the Israelis and the Palestinians, and many others around the world, are looking toward what happens after the fighting stops. As we hear from VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem, number one on the agenda, who will govern Gaza?
As the fighting rages between Israel and Hamas in Gaza and the death toll continues to climb, the international community is increasingly pressing for a ceasefire. But it's not clear who will eventually take control of Gaza and its 2.2 million people, many of whom lived in poverty before the war began. Mechaimer Abu Sada is a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University in Gaza.
It doesn't seem to me that there is even consensus among the U.S., Israel, the regional Arab country, the international community on what to do with Gaza after the war. Who's going to be ruling Gaza?
U.S. President Joe Biden has said he would like to see a revitalized Palestinian Authority, or PA, take control in Gaza once the war ends. But according to polls, 80 to 90% of Palestinians disapprove of the PA and its 88-year-old leader, Mahmoud Abbas. It is seen as corrupt and ineffective in the West Bank territory it already controls and incapable of governing Gaza. Nevertheless, some PA officials say they are prepared to return to Gaza 16 years after Hamas threw them out in a bloody coup. Hussein Sheikh is the Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization.
I say that it is the right of the PLO and the right of the Palestinian Authority to return to the Gaza Strip. Am I going to Mozambique? I'm going to my country and my people, and even if it is destroyed, it is my responsibility. But it must be within the framework of a comprehensive political vision that is supported regionally and internationally.
Palestinian analysts say that 17 years after the last parliamentary elections, Palestinians must elect more qualified leadership who can unite them. Tahani Mustafa is an expert on the Palestinians at the International Crisis Group.
You're having the international community look for an administration that can provide the technocratic levels of governance, like health, education, but misses the entire point of the fact that Palestinians want and need legitimate leaders. They want a leadership that can advocate for them, even if you're talking about on a diplomatic stage here or on a diplomatic level. And that is something that is completely missing in these discussions about the day after.
Egypt recently offered a three-stage peace proposal, starting with a two-week ceasefire and the release of 40 Israeli hostages, then the formation of a Palestinian technocratic government to hold elections, and finally a complete ceasefire in exchange for the release of all Israeli hostages, freedom for all Palestinian prisoners, and a complete Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. The Egyptian proposal leaves Hamas intact, which Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly said is unacceptable. Some Israeli analysts say the goal of eliminating Hamas is unrealistic. Michael Milstein is a former Army intelligence officer and a professor at Tel Aviv University.
Hamas, first of all, is an idea before an organization, and Hamas won't be vanished, even if thousands of Hamas terrorists and the political leaders will be killed during the war, they will still have dozens of thousands of supporters in Gaza and, of course, in other arenas like the West Bank.
Netanyahu maintains that neither Hamas nor the Palestinian Authority can play a role in the future of Gaza. But he has not laid out a plan for the future of the area, and it is not clear how Gaza will be governed or eventually rebuilt. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Hamas is a U.S. designated terrorist group. As we just heard in that report, there isn't a consensus about who should govern Gaza. Joe Truesman is a research analyst with the nonpartisan Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. To say it will be difficult to come up with a post-war plan for Gaza, he says, is a major understatement. But a recent proposal from Egypt is a good starting point.
I mean, the Egyptians have a lot of experience in this with the Israelis. They have a lot of experience with Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad and other Palestinian terrorist organizations, since simply due to the previous conflicts that have occurred between the parties in previous years. So Egypt has always acted as a mediator, all right? So they have Egyptian intelligence has a special case or a special file. It's usually referred to as the Palestinian file. Basically, Egyptian intelligence deals with the Palestinians, Hamas specifically, routinely on a regular basis, especially Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza. At least there's maybe some trust there with the Egyptians, okay?
Do you see any way that Hamas gets a role in the future?
That's a very difficult question, because if you believe what the Israelis are saying publicly, or just what they're saying, rather, they can't live beside of Hamas, that, you know, they have to destroy Hamas, then the answer is no. Now, would they be open to Hamas and in some sort of, you know, unity government with the Palestinian Authority? I couldn't tell you for sure.
I think even today they said the number one thing that you hear is, oh, well, the Palestinian Authority will take over. But Israel, I think today said no.
I mean, they can't. Even there's no, you know, the thing is, the Palestinian Authority cannot even govern the West Bank properly. All right. That's the problem. If they can't govern the West Bank properly, and that is with a surge of violence that has been going on for about 2.5 years, mostly led by Palestinian terrorist organizations, they certainly cannot govern post-war Gaza. You know, they can't do it. So, I mean, even with how, I mean, they in the West Bank, they're already getting help. They're getting aid from foreign donors, right? So even the Israelis are helping them as far as security. There's a security cooperation between the Palestinians.
Is there another player that can step in?
Right. I don't think so. I don't think anybody really has come forth, or I can really say, oh yeah, for sure this person. Well, if it can't be Hamas, it can't be the Palestinian Authority, who else is it going to be? I haven't seen anyone. I can't answer that question, unfortunately. You know, there are other people that are involved in, we're supposed to look at the Palestinian Authority or Fatah. The Fatah party, like Mohammed Dahlan, who is in, I believe, he actually resides in the UAE, and he's like, he's basically a rival of President Abbas. I don't think there are many takers who wants to govern Gaza, to be quite honest with you, just because it's just such a mess.
Joe Truesman, a research analyst at the Nonpartisan Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. He's heading to the region this week, and we'll hopefully talk to him again as this thorny issue moves forward. More troubling news about Iran from a new UN Atomic Agency watchdog report. It says Iran is increasing its production of highly enriched uranium. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The International Atomic Energy Agency said in a report to member states that Iran has increased the rate at which it's producing near weapons-grade uranium in recent weeks. The move is reversing a previous slowdown that started in the middle of this year, according to the agency. Iran had previously slowed down the rate at which it was enriching uranium to 60% purity. Uranium enriched at 60% purity is just a short technical step away from weapons-grade levels of 90%. I'm Karen Chamas.
After following these stories from around the world, U.S. President Joe Biden ordered the United States military to carry out retaliatory airstrikes against Iranian-backed militia groups after three U.S. service members were injured in a drone attack in northern Iraq. Iraqi officials say the U.S. strikes targeted militia sites early Tuesday, killing one militant and wounding 18. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny says he was fine after a pretty exhausting 20-day transfer from his prison near Moscow to a penal colony beyond the Arctic Circle. Posting on X, he showed he still has a sense of humor, writing, "Unfortunately, there are no reindeer, but there are huge, fluffy, and very beautiful shepherd dogs." Thousands gathered in front of the Central Election Commission building in Belgrade on Tuesday to protest a Serbian election earlier this month that international monitors said was unfair. A defeated opposition candidate told the crowd, "We will not recognize the election theft, and the electoral will of the citizens of Belgrade will be defended." Ukraine hit a Russian ship in a Crimean port on Tuesday. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder reports that Ukraine's ability to attack Russian shipping is significant.
Ukraine struck a large Russian warship in Crimea with cruise missiles in an overnight attack that killed at least one person. Footage obtained by Reuters shows the moment of a large explosion at the Crimean port of Feodosia on Tuesday. Reuters was able to confirm the location of the video. Ukrainian Air Force spokesperson Yuri Ihnat did not specify what kind of cruise missile was used, but both Britain and France have supplied Kyiv with such weapons. Russia's defense ministry, cited by the Interfax news agency, said this large landing ship, the Novocherkassk, had been damaged. The strike could hinder Russian attempts to seize more Ukrainian territory along the Black Sea coast. Buildings in the Crimean port city of Feodosia were damaged, probably by the blast wave from a large explosion. Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine in 2014 in a move Kyiv and the West condemned as an illegal seizure. Russia has hinted it may try to seize more Ukrainian territory along the Black Sea coast. President Vladimir Putin earlier this month said that Odessa, the headquarters of Ukraine's own navy, was a Russian city. Sergei Aksionov, the Russian-installed governor of Crimea, said on Telegram that one person had been killed. The RIA news agency said four people had been injured. A Ukrainian counteroffensive has made little in the way of battlefield gains, and the Russian military has regained the initiative in several places. But Ukraine has been able to inflict serious damage in attacks on Crimea, the headquarters of Russia's Black Sea Fleet. Previous attacks have targeted ships in dry docks, warships moored in the port of Sevastopol, airfields, the main Black Sea Fleet HQ building, and the bridge which connects southern Russia to Crimea.
Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder, who says Russia has used its fleet to impede Ukraine's access to the Black Sea, the main export route for the agriculture and steel exports that make up a significant chunk of Ukraine's economy. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. The Colorado River in the southwest U.S. supplies water for 40 million people. But the biggest user of Colorado River water isn't people. It's farming. In the third installment of his series, River at Risk, VOA's Matt Dibble takes us to a valley in the desert that grows a large percentage of the U.S. vegetable crop.
This canal sends water to California's Imperial Valley. It's where the largest share of Colorado River water gets used for growing crops in an area that otherwise would be a desert. Water rights for the valley are held by the Imperial Irrigation District, which has allocated about 3 million acre-feet of water per year, more than the states of Arizona and Nevada combined. It has senior water rights, according to the 100-year-old Colorado Compact Agreement, making it the last user required to take cuts in the event of a shortage. Tina Shields is a water manager for the Imperial Irrigation District.
We're big in the winter vegetables. If you're eating lettuce in December, it's probably coming from here or the Yuma Valleys.
The irrigation district supplies water to over 200,000 hectares, which in 2022 produced $2.6 billion worth of crops and livestock. It's a system that has worked for decades when reservoirs were full.
Now we're at some of these critical elevations, which we would love to ignore and just say we have senior water rights, but it turns out it's our only water supply.
With the Colorado River system threatened, the district agreed in May 2023 to reduce the water it provides farmers by about 25% for the next 3 years, in return for federal funds. Stephen Hawk is a fourth-generation farmer in the valley.
There are going to have to be cuts, and it will affect how we farm here. You know, I try to be as judicious as I can with the water that I'm given. I know it's a very important resource. I don't want to waste a drop.
For over a decade, the agency has been helping farmers fund the expense of transitioning to more water-efficient irrigation systems, like sprinklers and drip. The program is paid for with water sales to cities. Sprinklers are helping conserve water, but critics say water is being wasted on crops that humans don't eat. More than half of the fields here grow alfalfa and other grasses used to feed livestock. They are lucrative crops grown year-round in the valley, but they also consume the most water.
While it could be a little bit controversial, it also has given us sustainability. Our margins on a lot of the crops that we grow are so razor thin, it's very easy. I know a lot of people that have gone under.
Hawk now grows more vegetables and less alfalfa than he used to. But he doubts that he could find buyers if he replaced all his alfalfa fields with produce.
We only grow what the demand is for. So if people want to eat hamburgers and have milkshakes, then we've got to produce enough alfalfa and forage to feed the cows.
The most drastic adaptation would be taking fields out of production completely. That is not supported by the irrigation district management.
It's not good for our community. It causes additional unemployment and third-party impacts on all those farm-related businesses.
Instead, Shields says they are considering cutting off water to crops such as alfalfa for a few months of the year. As this farming community waits to see how it will be affected by falling water levels, Hawk hopes his farm will survive to pass on to the next generation. Matt Dibble, VOA News, Holtsville, California.
And finally, living on the moon. A moon base is central to U.S. space agency NASA's plans. They hope to have humans on the moon within 2 years. So what will a moon city look like? Well, you've probably already seen it. Mike O'Sullivan reports Hollywood has been building moon cities for the movies for decades.
Danger, adventure.
Living on the moon, as imagined in the 1953 film Project Moonbase, in a future in space of discovery and excitement. Or just plain fun, like these youngsters playing baseball on the moon in a scene from the recent Disney film Crater. Lunar life may soon be real, thanks to the Artemis program, which launched the uncrewed Artemis 1 mission around the moon in November 2022. Artemis will send 4 astronauts on a lunar flyby next November with Artemis 2, and is slated to return humans to the moon with Artemis 3 no earlier than 2025. Artemis will also create a space station in lunar orbit called Gateway, an outpost for future missions to the moon and a staging point for future deep space exploration. 2 major modules should be in place by late 2025. The project adheres to the Artemis Accords, a non-binding agreement between the United States and, as of December 2023, 32 other countries. The Accords call for peaceful exploration, mutual assistance, and sharing scientific data from space.
We've got India signed this year. We have very small countries, Luxembourg, for example, Singapore, and we have African countries. Angola is the most recent signatory, Rwanda.
Other signatories include Japan, Canada, and 13 European nations, but not Russia or China. A Russian official called the NASA-led agreement too U.S.-centric. The two countries plan to build their own joint lunar research station. Artemis relies on commercial partners, an important precedent, says the head of a company that built the fuel tank for an upcoming support mission.
Because you want to be able, for example, to have tourists. All right, well, tourists are going to have to be in a hotel. Well, I got to build a hotel. Right? Now, can I do all of this? Does all of this make sense? And the answer is, I do believe it does.
He says we have the technology and that lunar resources include frozen water and helium-3, which scientists say could fast-track energy production when practical fusion reactors are developed. Analysts say NASA works well with private partners.
The U.S. in particular has been pretty supportive of encouraging companies and other countries to use resources on the moon and develop the capability to do that. You know, part of the idea there is that that helps to make space travel more sustainable, helps to develop these new technologies, move those things forward.
Do the movies get it right? A permanent base or bases won't be built until at least the 2030s. But scientists say some Hollywood images may become reality as the Artemis program puts the pieces in place for a human return to the moon and beyond. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
After circumnavigating the moon and beyond,
this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform or online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Ideally, Afghanistan would be fully reintegrated within the international system without passing through a further cycle of violence and in accordance with international law, according to a recent United Nations Independent Assessment on Afghanistan report. It's something to work toward, but right now too many problems stand in the way, said Special Representative of the Secretary General for Afghanistan and head of the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, Rosa Otunbayeva. Speaking before the UN Security Council, as the representatives debated whether to engage in dialogue with the Taliban, she recounted productive engagement with the Taliban on a number of topics, including human rights and governance. On the other hand, the return of the Taliban to power has seen the emergence of an alarming pattern of human rights violations across the board. So the question is there a benefit to starting a dialogue with the Taliban? The United States Alternate Representative for Special Political Affairs, Robert Wood, highlighted three pressing topics that need to be resolved. First, Afghan women urged the United Nations to stress to the Taliban that it must include women in all sectors of society, said Ambassador Wood.
The United States hears their requests and will not consider any significant steps toward normalization of relations with the Taliban until women and girls have meaningful access to education, the workforce, and other aspects of social and political life.
Second, the Taliban is hindering humanitarian access, notably through restrictions on female humanitarian staff, said Ambassador Wood.
The United States is committed to providing assistance to those most in need. Since 2021, we have provided over $2 billion U.S. dollars in assistance. It is imperative to recognize that humanitarian assistance alone is not enough. That is why the Taliban must reverse their policies that keep women from contributing to Afghanistan's economy.
And finally, the United States welcomes the UN's independent assessment on Afghanistan, which calls for the appointment of a special envoy and establishing an international contact group. They will be important for the development of a roadmap that ensures Afghanistan meets its international obligations. The Security Council must continue to work together to press the Taliban to reverse their destructive course, said Ambassador Wood. The Taliban must engage in serious dialogue with the Afghan people to support their aspirations, to put an end to human rights abuses, and to allow assistance to reach those in need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.